ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you think you'd never be caught out by disinformation? Well, cast your mind back. Remember that big story about the bedbugs at the Paris Olympics? Well, that was actually a very effective Russian disinformation campaign. So effective that most people still believe it to this day. G'day, it's Hamish McDonald here. And I've learned that disinformation can be surprisingly subtle and hard to spot. If you want to join me interrogating the dark world of disinformation, stream The Matter of Facts now on ABC iView.
Hello, this is David Rutledge and we are in the Philosopher's Zone once again. Welcome to the show. You may very well be familiar with the story of Captain Lawrence Oates. Oates was a British Army officer and Antarctic explorer who died in 1912 at the age of 32. He had been part of an expedition to the South Pole that ran into extremely difficult conditions on the return journey, with intense cold and relentless blizzards. All the members of the expedition were suffering, but Oates was in a particularly bad way. He had severe frostbite and gangrene in his feet, he was suffering terrible pain from an old war wound in his leg, and his condition was forcing the team to move at a very slow pace. Well, eventually, he took the decision to end his own life in order to give his companions a better chance of survival and reaching help. On the 16th of March 1912, Oates uttered the immortal words, "I am just going outside and maybe some time," walked out of his tent into the blizzard and was never seen again. And as a result of this, Captain Lawrence Oates has gone down in history as an emblem of selfless courage. Realising that he was unable to go on, Oates relieved his companions of the burden of his continued existence. He also relieved them of the moral burden of having to decide whether or not to abandon him. Now, it's very unlikely that you or I will ever find ourselves faced with a life or death decision somewhere out there in the freezing wilderness. But we may, when we come to the end of our lives, be confronted with the feeling that we have become a burden. It's not uncommon for the elderly or the terminally ill to consider themselves a burden on the medical system, a burden on their caregivers or their family members, and often their caregivers are their family members. And what we're talking about this week is that feeling of burdensomeness and how it plays into the issue of medically assisted dying. Is the terminally ill person who seeks assisted dying in order to relieve their families of the burden of care displaying the same sort of clear-eyed moral courage as Captain Lawrence Oates? Or is the feeling of burdensomeness at the end of life just a tragic misperception, something to be discouraged or denied? Well, my guest this week is Liesl van Zyl. She's a specialist in virtue ethics and lecturer in philosophy at the University of Waikato in New Zealand. And just a content warning, this episode contains discussions of suicide and mental health struggles that some listeners might find distressing. If we can begin with virtue ethics, because I think there are two kinds of moral philosophy that are broadly familiar, I would say, to most of our listeners. One is the utilitarian approach. It argues that the best action is the one that maximizes well-being for the greatest number of people or minimizes suffering. And then there's the one that focuses on the rights of individuals to have their own well-being protected or their own suffering alleviated. How is virtue ethics different from these approaches? And what does it focus on that these approaches maybe miss?
Utilitarianism can probably be quite useful when making decisions like how to allocate a healthcare budget. You know, how do we get the most bang for our buck? And so one might argue that instead of developing services to provide assisted dying, we might spend our money better on improving palliative care. But of course, I mean, utilitarianism and that line of thinking can also have some repugnant conclusions, like, you know, maybe we liberalize assisted dying laws and end up saving a lot of money. Like, I think they've found in Canada that that's one of the side effects. So I think the problem is that you lose sight of the individual. The individual's well-being and their interests and needs are just one among many. So I think on the other hand, a rights-based approach, I mean, I think it is important to acknowledge a right to refuse treatment, you know, and other kinds of rights. You know, physicians have a duty to respect those rights. But it's a very minimalistic kind of approach. It generally sort of tells you what not to do, but it doesn't say much about what it means to treat a patient well or to allow someone to die with dignity. So I think virtue ethics exactly focuses on those types of questions as, what does it mean to treat a patient well? That is, with compassion, with respect, with kindness, and so on. I think more importantly, it focuses on questions about what matters in life. You know, what are things that are important to us as human beings? What is a good life? I think with that also, what is a good death?
And so the word virtue in virtue ethics, this points to what? A sort of moral character, the idea of what a virtuous person would do in a particular situation?
The term virtue is a bit old-fashioned, but the more specific virtues that we're all very much familiar with, like honesty, courage, compassion. So the question would be, like, what would a virtuous person do, or what would be an honest or kind or just thing to do in this situation? But yeah, the other side of that, I think that's just as important, is that the virtues are defined with reference to what it means to live a good life, for human beings to flourish as the kind of beings we are. And so I think in this context, that's especially important in thinking of what is involved in living a good life, where good is an attractive life, but also a morally good life.
Many debates around euthanasia focus on this idea of autonomy, the autonomy of the patient, the autonomy of the dying person. Why do you think that virtue ethics might provide a better framework?
The autonomy model, and we find that a lot, that the justification for euthanasia or assisted dying is this idea that, I have a right to self-determination. It's my body, my life, I should have a right to decide how and when to die. But if you think of it, like in the case of euthanasia, you're not just asking someone to not interfere with your ability to lead your life the way you like to. You're actually asking them to help you end your life. And so a right to self-determination, I think, is better thought of as a right to non-interference. Whereas with assisted dying, you are asking for interference. You are asking someone to do something for you. And so there, it's a rights-based approach where the idea is that the job of the physician is to respect a patient's autonomy, to give them what they want. So then you've sort of lost the idea of the role of medicine being to fulfill a certain purpose. They really become tools or instruments. They just, like a commercial arrangement. If you want to have some medical care, you go buy it if you could afford it. And the physician is just going to give you what you want. But if you think, the role of medicine is to actually promote flourishing, to allow us to live better lives, then it should be important for the physician to be motivated in the right way. So their reason for providing a certain service is not simply, this is what the patient wants, I have to respect their wishes. Rather, it would be something like, this could help them, this could benefit them, this could relieve their suffering. So we see a lot in places where, like in some places in America, where a patient has a right to medical assistance in dying if they are competent and if they are terminally ill.
Are you talking about the state of Oregon in the USA here?
This
is where. Yeah. The interesting thing there is it makes me wonder about how medical practitioners in Oregon and in places that have similar laws, what it's like for them to be expected or required to just administer assisted dying on request. Does that come into the issue here for you, the burden on the physician?
Yes, I think it's a huge burden on a physician. Someone who's trained to prolong life, cure disease and so on, to now suddenly be asked to end it. But it seems to me that many of them just opt out, that they do have a right to conscientious objection. Some of them just simply say, look, I don't want to have anything to do with this. But the interesting thing is, if you look at the reasons that are given for requesting assisted dying in Oregon, suffering and pain and physical symptoms are just not at the top of the list. The most important, most common reason that they give is that they want to control the circumstances of their death. They want to die when and where and how they want to die. So the other thing one should note about that system is that the death itself does not take place in a hospital setting or a medical setting. As the physician just writes a script and sends the patient home, and they can fill the script and take the drug whenever they want to. So that does give them an opportunity to kind of arrange a living funeral, kind of a function where they can, you know, and invite their friends and family and play music and have a little ceremony. So one might find that an attractive kind of system, but I think that what it does to medical profession is that it becomes more of a commercial arrangement where they're just supplying people with what they want without necessarily being convinced that that's going to be good for the patient or that that's the right decision.
You've taken up this issue of the dying person as a burden. And just to get us into that, can you tell me about the reality of that? Because there is a reality there. Like, caring for a dying person can and does put all kinds of pressure on health practitioners, family members who are caring for them. What do those pressures and those sacrifices typically look like?
Most people say they don't want to be a burden on family, but then they also say they want to die at home, and dying at home is hugely burdensome to family. So if you think of the financial cost, the additional expenses, maybe time off work, or, you know, someone might have to give up a job altogether, there's lost income, the emotional burden, I mean, it's difficult to be seeing someone slowly fade away or suffer. I mean, the whole household needs to be transformed into a kind of a medical environment. So, you know, it's disruptive to education, socializing, and so on. So it is very, very difficult. But most families, from research I've seen, most families, they're happy to provide that care, and they will insist that it's not too much of a burden. But sometimes it seems to me that it's too much of a burden. It comes at too high a cost. In some cases, the financial strain on the family means that they there's maybe a loss of career or loss of family home even. Some people end up with chronic pain and injury from the physical demands of having to lift the patient. Interesting statistics is about 95% of family caregivers end up with what doctors refer to as clinically irrelevant distress. So emotional exhaustion, sense of powerlessness. So that's almost inevitable. And then about 10 to 20% of caregivers end up developing a prolonged grief disorder. It's a very debilitating form of grief characterized by persistent depression and so on. So in those cases, you could say, well, look, that's too much to ask of someone to provide the care if that's the cost of it. Now, I think obviously the answer to that, the solution to that, is not that people refuse the care, but that society do more to actually provide support in those cases.
On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, this is The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and my guest this week is Liesl van Zyl from the University of Waikato in New Zealand. We're talking about assisted dying and feelings of burdensomeness at the end of life. We talked earlier about the state of Oregon in the USA, where physician-assisted suicide is available to terminally ill patients, regardless of their reasons for seeking it. What do we know about the reasons why terminally ill people in Oregon seek medical assistance in dying? And how frequently does this perception of being a burden to others come up among those reasons?
It's difficult to interpret the data that's coming out of Oregon, but from what I can tell, it's about roughly 50% of cases, patients do mention burdensomeness. So that's a very common concern, but it's not often the sole concern. It's usually there are a few reasons why people seek out assisted dying. So the top reason, I think, would be wanting to control the circumstances of their death, wanting to decide when and where and how to die. But other concerns are just things like, you know, that they less capable of engaging in enjoyable activities. A lot of them are cited as sort of a loss of dignity or a loss of sense of self. So other reasons would be like fears for the future. It's not even to do with their present circumstances, but they worry about future quality of life, their loss of independence, maybe future pain or loss of identity. But yes, not wanting to be a burden or not wanting others to take care of them is a factor in about half the cases.
This makes me think of the, well, I've come to think of as the Captain Oates case of perceived burdensomeness. And of course, Captain Lawrence Oates being this heroic figure who willingly walked out of his tent to die in a blizzard rather than compromise his companion's chances of survival. And the fact that Oates is seen as a hero indicates that concerns about burdensomeness at the end of life are not always pathological, even if they serve as a motivation for suicide. Can you tell me more about that in the medical context?
Yeah, so in the medical context, they sometimes, well, they often mention this notion of self-perceived burdensomeness. But the kind of burdensomeness that we're talking about in the Captain Oates case is quite different. It's like, here's someone who made a judgment that suicide would relieve others of the burden of taking care of him.
And more than just taking care of him, it, as you've pointed out, it relieved his fellows of the moral burden of having to decide whether or not to abandon him, which I think is an interesting aspect to it.
Yeah, so you think, well, what is the burden that he relieved them of? Well, you know, they could have just left him there and continued. I mean, that would have been within their rights to do that. But they would have felt terrible. And so I think that's the burden that he relieved them of, is not having to make that decision. But, I mean, the Oates case does not translate very well into the assisted dying context at all. Well, in the first place, that Oates did not ask his teammates to help him end his life. He did it himself. And also, but the situation was very different. So for Oates, like in many cases of terminal illness, death was inevitable and imminent. But I think that's probably where the similarities end. So he had some control over how he died. So his first option was just to encourage his teammates to continue without him. So this is not leaving him behind in a hut or anything. I think they would have taken the tents and equipment and everything with him. So, you know, leaving him behind in a blizzard would be a terrible thing. He could have begged them to stay, in which case they all would have died. So the other option then was suicide, which is just walking off into the storm, which one can say, well, that's good for him, as like he died a heroic death and, you know, he would have died in any case. But it's also good for others in that he made it easier on them. So that's a very different situation from the assisted dying one, where the benefit to others is not the same at all.
Where I'm inclined to see maybe not a similarity between the two cases, but I find it very interesting that, you know, we have here a somewhat confronting take on the notion of what it means to die a good death. You know, good death generally being understood as good from the perspective of the person who's dying. But this story invokes a sense in which a good death could also be seen as a death that's good for others who are within the orbit of the dying person. And in the medical context, that would mean, you know, caregivers, family members, and so on. Is that, to some extent, how you see it?
So, yes, I mean, Aristotle remarked that humans are social animals. So, in a sense, you can't talk about a good life or a good death without also talking about other people. And so I think that's one problem with a very individualistic approach, that it's all just about this patient. And so a good death, I think you would, I mean, in one sense would be, you know, an easy death, one that's not prolonged or that doesn't involve too much suffering for the one who dies. But part of it would also be a death that's not too hard for others. So how the dying person relates to those around them would also be an important part of the death. So I'm thinking about things like getting your affairs in order so that it doesn't make it too difficult for other people. You know, that would be one way in which one can have a good death in that more social sense. As a terminal patient, you know, being grateful, being generous, being courageous, not making unreasonable demands. I mean, those are all ways in which you can make it easier for those around you, making peace with others, saying goodbye, and so on. But yes, there is that does raise the question, well, wouldn't it be an act of courage if I asked for an assisted dying in order to spare my loved ones further suffering?
So what's the answer to that question? Can choosing medically assisted dying in order to avoid imposing a burden on others be a virtuous act?
Yeah, so we might think, well, choosing an earlier death will make things easier for our family, and it might well do just that, but not necessarily. I think it might actually make it harder for them if you say, well, look, I'm doing this for your sake. They might say, well, look, we really don't want you to do that for our sake. But let's say this is a case where, you know, you judge correctly that this will make it easier for everyone. Well, then you should also, you know, keep in mind that you're asking a physician to help you end your life. So unlike Oates, you need someone to help you end your life. And so it could well be that you are imposing a burden on them. Some of the research shows that being involved in assisted dying is hugely burdensome to physicians, that it's takes a huge emotional and psychological toll on them. In Australia and New Zealand, a lot of physicians also complain about the additional workload. If you want to do it properly, then you have to do rigorous assessments, and documentation is hugely time consuming. I mean, that's a problem we can work on. But the emotional and psychological burden on physicians is significant. So then one might say, well, you know, they're just doing their job. You know, that's what they're there for, is they have to carry these burdens. They're trained to do things that are difficult. I think the question is, well, is it their job? Is that really what we want their job to be, is to end our lives for the sake of others? So I think here we have to distinguish between two kinds of cases. So on one hand, say I'm experiencing unbearable suffering, I'm terminally ill, and I'm concerned about how my suffering affects others. So in a sense, I want to protect others from my suffering. I mean, in that kind of situation, I think asking for assisted dying is admirable. We've been virtuous. I mean, it's courageous. It could be prudent in the sense that it's in your own best interests, and it's considerate of others. And I think that, you know, if you can get a physician to help you, they might do so knowing that they're doing this for your sake. This is the best thing for you, possibly. So it's an emotional burden probably on them, but it's a burden I think that we can expect them to bear. And indeed, it seems that many physicians do find it meaningful, that they feel like they're providing an important service, that they're relieving someone's suffering. So in that kind of situation, yes, but the other kind of situation where I'm terminally ill, I'm not suffering so much, or maybe I'm not suffering to the extent that I find it unbearable, but I'm thinking, well, I just want to relieve my family of the burden of taking care of me. You know, this is a sacrifice I'm prepared to make. Now, that sounds very altruistic and considerate, but I think that is just unfair on a physician to ask them to help me. And I think that's exactly what's happening in Oregon and other places in the USA, where terminal illness is the sole criterion. And in those cases, many physicians report feeling guilty, or, you know, a sense of moral distress after having been involved in those cases. And I think that's not surprising at all.
Well, there are, of course, around the world, jurisdictions where assisted dying laws are very liberal. We've talked about Oregon in the USA, but we could also look at somewhere like the Netherlands. In other jurisdictions that are more restrictive, we often hear the slippery slope argument deployed, this idea that if medically assisted dying is made easily available to people who want to end their lives, then what we're going to see is a large increase in the numbers of people seeking it out. There are concerns about how, in the Netherlands, for example, it's possible to access assisted dying for psychiatric conditions like severe depression. Is that in fact what's happening? And what about the numbers?
Yes, I think that's exactly what's happening in the Netherlands. And from the beginning, the idea was to, you know, that it's about relieving suffering. And, you know, they started off cautiously and restricted it to people who are competent. But, you know, inevitably at some point, you know, someone said, well, but what about people who's suffering from conditions that are not terminal? And, you know, what about people who are suffering from psychiatric illnesses? Aren't we discriminating against them? You know, what about children? And so, I mean, there are cases in the Netherlands where people have been granted assisted dying because of depression or those kinds of conditions. And I think a lot of people feel uneasy with that. And one of the reasons is that depression or other mental illnesses is very difficult to make that judgment that ending life is in this person's best interest. One would hope that it might be something that can still be done. But also, I mean, the other problem, of course, is to determine that they're really competent to make that decision. So it's happened, I mean, it has happened, 26 years now that it's been legalized in the Netherlands. And I don't think you could say there's a huge explosion of cases. I mean, currently in the Netherlands, there's only like 5% or so of the total deaths are from euthanasia, and most of them would be, you know, terminal illness or serious physical conditions. Interestingly, in Oregon, I mean, the euthanasia or assisted dying has been legal there for probably as long, but it's still very, very uncommon for people to die by assisted dying there. The reasons for that would be more complex, but that'd be religion, that it's not really advertised. People don't really know that they have access to that. But one could expect, you know, a jurisdiction where there's a right to end your life or right to assisted dying when you're terminally ill, and that's the only requirement, that could become very popular. It's like, you know, it could become the new thing. And the only thing that's limiting the incidents of assisted dying would be contingent factors of the society.
Liesl van Zyl, she's lecturer in philosophy at the University of Waikato in New Zealand. And that brings us to the end of the Philosopher's Zone for another week. You can find guest details on our website. You can listen to this episode along with past episodes via ABC Listen. And I hope you can join me again next time. The Philosopher's Zone is produced on Bundjalung Country by me, David Rutledge. Bye for now.